Let's start this afternoon session. Herbert Levine will tell us about
the first part of the Euclid's work for biological systems is you have to get a pronunciation guide. Terry, I was happily coming up here to just talk to a couple people today, and Terry sends me an email saying, why don't you give a tutorial on something that apparently several of you saw the movies of last week by Yanagida, who was looking at one aspect of this problem, looking at imaging cyclic AMP receptor. So I'm just going to give you some general overview of what the cystelium is, what it does that's interesting, and what I'm currently trying to understand, I mean, where my own research is going. So that's what that is. And the reason for the PowerPoint is just that, you know, there are lots of nice movies and pictures, and I can't show it any other way. So the cystelium is an organism that has a interesting life cycle. It's an organism that lives a single cell. It's an organism that lives a single cell existence in the soil, eating bacteria and happily avoiding its neighbors. And it goes on like that indefinitely, as long as there's enough food to eat. And the thing that's interesting about it is that when the food runs out, which either happens in the wild, where it just happens to be eating everything locally, or happens very easily in the laboratory, where you grow it on in a test tube with some nutrient media, and then at some point, time zero, you remove the cells from the nutrient media and put them on a surface that has no food. So when they start starving, what they do is they institute some genetic program which changes their behavior. They start to cooperate. They start to signal each other and move in response to those signals. And it takes them about 8 hours to form localized clumps of cells. Localized clumps of cells, and we'll talk about how you get there from isolated cells in a minute. And then over the next, the whole thing takes about 24 hours. The final stage is this thing called a fruiting body. A fruiting body is a stalk with a round spore head on top. 80% of the cells turn into spores. 20% of the cells die to make the stalk. And this thing can then sit around for a long time waiting for better days. So the spores are resistant to, you know, they don't need food, they're resistant to humidity changes. They can be carried to faraway places by passing small animals or by currents or whatever. And if the spore happens to chance upon a region where there is food, then by some not really understood mechanism, the spores will germinate, they will break open, and new cystelium amoeba will crawl out and start again the, you know, plentiful food part of its life cycle. So that's what the organism does. There's no division during that part, during that process. Yes.
When they come out of spores.
When they come out of spores, then they go back to each spore gives rise to one amoeba, and then they eat, and then they divide and behave like every other single cell organism until again the food runs out.
It looks as if in that progress from the clump to the final form, there was some regression in that far right form.
This one?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it makes some decision about when to do this. It has a sort of decision pathway here, whether to go into a sort of migrating worm-like thing called a slug, or whether to go directly into this final pathway. Most of the time, it sort of goes into this thing, and then it sort of comes back to here and keeps going. But it depends on the condition. So it's somehow searching for a good place to do this. If it doesn't like the region locally, then it forms this thing. This is a rudimentary multicellular creature with 10 to the 4th cells in it that crawls along looking for environmental clues. It does, for example, in response to light intensity. It will crawl towards the light. And then eventually it will detect some local environment that it likes and then will form the fruiting body.
What is it that it likes about the local?
I think it's basically the one of the things it likes is the light intensity. This thing lives in the soil. It wants to get high up so that its dispersal chances, or dispersal chances are higher. But that, you know, I mean, there's an ecology of these creatures, which is not really what those people study, but there has been some studies of that.
Yeah, the worm becomes nutrients.
Yeah, it breaks open. So this is not terminally differentiated. In here, if it encounters nutrients, it can still revert back directly to the unseen individual cells. So around this stage, I should mention, there are a number of reasons why this is a favorite organism for people who are interested in developmental biology. Starting from more or less, you know, genetically, certainly identical individual cells, somewhere around this time, the cells differentiate into two cell types, ones that eventually will become the spores and ones that eventually will become the stalks. They're not quite there yet because I said they're still plastic to some extent at this stage. But that differentiation takes place in a spatially uniform manner as far as most people have been able to measure. So just randomly in position in this mound, 20% of the cells decide to become stalk, 80% of the cells decide to become spore. Nobody really knows the underlying biochemistry of that decision process, but it's much simpler than obviously the similar decision process that any eukaryotic organism would make when it decides on which cells will become liver and heart and brain. So this is the simplest case. There's sort of two major cell types, and you can identify pretty clearly when the decision is taking place. That's not what we're going to talk about, but nonetheless. Now, I'll show you a movie in a second. The reason I'm doing PowerPoint is just because the movies are nice and I have no other way to show them. The first part of the process is what most people who have been interested in looking at this system from a sort of physics or mathematical biology perspective or whatever you want to call it, most people are focused on the aggregation process, the process that gets you from individual isolated cells to those clumps. The reason why people have done that is just because the cells in that during that process are not touching each other. They're, typically maybe a couple of cell diameters apart. They're communicating with each other only via a fairly well understood chemical signaling system. And so much of the complication of multicellular biology having to do with cells directly in contact with each other and cell adhesion. Oh, my voice is that bad?
No, you're good.
You recorded for
posterity, okay. Loud enough for this room.
Good. No hard turning on this, Rich.
Just
put it on.
Just put it on?
There's a fair chance it'll work.
Okay. So the thing about this aggregation stage, which has caught the interest of many people and which I think, as I say, is fairly well understood, is the fact that the aggregation takes place via a set of nonlinear waves in which the cells use to communicate with each other. Let me show you the next one. It's probably better because you can actually watch the waves. So here are nonlinear waves it's just repeating. The image, what you're actually seeing here is called dark field waves because what you're actually imaging is the scattered light off the cells. What's been shown in several experiments and one particular rather heroic experiment of about 15 years ago by now, is that this pattern, which is the scattered light pattern, correlates very well with waves of increased concentration of a particular chemical, which is cyclic AMP. So it's a particular organic molecule which is propagating in this system, and what you see in this pattern is, first of all, the organization of the wave field typically involves these nice rotating spiral waves. The dark spots, I think, are just colored in spiral cores. This
was just a study of spiral waves in the system. And the other thing is, I don't know if you can see that quite, if you look at some spot over here where the waves are colliding, you'll notice that unlike linear waves, these waves, when they hit each other, annihilate each other directly. And the reason for that is very simple. I mean, the analogy which all my students like is the one with forest fires. You have some process which is akin to setting a flame and exciting the material, which after a while becomes non-responsive, burns out, and requires some time to regenerate. And if you have two wave fronts that hit each other, then all the cells in the vicinity of those two wave fronts have now gone refractory, are no longer responsive, and the wave front has nowhere to go. The great advantage of that, let me just finish the, go back if I can manage to make it back to the previous slide. Sure. Yeah, it's been measured. It's 300 microns per minute is the number that... It's a reaction diffusion wave. So it's, you know, the, it's, so there's a class of waves which, excuse me, which go by the general name of excitable waves. Some examples that originally arose in the pure chemistry literature were the Belousov-Shabotinsky reaction, and more recently, various catalytic reactions. The reaction that takes carbon monoxide, attaches it to a platinum surface, and releases carbon dioxide, which is otherwise known as a catalytic converter. Actually, if you image the surface, you again see these types of waves. So it's a fairly well-known type of nonlinear wave that can exist in reaction diffusion systems. And the other system which very strongly exhibits these waves are heart cells. As your heart, as the pacemaker in your heart fires, then what happens is a wave passes through your myocardium and eventually tells all the cells to contract. And so there's a huge literature on these waves in general. Yeah.
Yeah, what are we actually seeing in the cubic wave?
Yeah, so that's what I was trying, I tried to say that a little bit briefly. What you know, if you're an experimentalist and want to make your biggest impact on dictyostelium, you would find a way of directly measuring the cyclic AMP concentration. No one has been able to do that. So although everybody believes that the waves are involved with cyclic AMP chemicals passing from cell to cell, and there's a million reasons to think that, including one experiment which directly tried to measure cyclic AMP as a snapshot, which they managed to do. There was no motion of the waves, but you can measure it as a snapshot if you, you know, do it the right way. What you're actually seeing is you're actually seeing a coherent change in the shape of the cells as the cyclic AMP passes over them. So the cell goes from being sort of elongated to sort of pulling in all its pseudopods in sort of what's called cringing. So the cell, you know, is sort of this, you'll see pictures of these individual cells in a second when we talk about cell, how they respond chemotactically. But the cells sort of look like your standard amoeba spread out on the surface. The wave passes over it and the cell sort of does this. And that's enough, since that happens sort of coherently over many cells, it's enough to pick up as a change in the light scattering of the... And that's been, you know, that was noticed about 20 or 30 years ago. And the group that I showed you has been the one that's been the pioneer, in some sense, the pioneering group in pushing that technology as far as possible. Yes, sir. Many. You're going to make me remember that. So if I look at this picture, you would typically say in a large spiral here, there would be maybe 10,000 or maybe 50, maybe between, let's say a large spiral might be 50,000 cells. So in this spiral here, in this region here, there might be 50,000 cells. So these are large. These are, you know, this is a single Petri dish, which is, you know, the usual size of a Petri dish. So this is a macroscopic effect in these. Now, just one thing about the waves. The reason these waves are so useful for the cells is that they basically manage, because of this annihilation effect at, you know, when with wave fronts, they manage to essentially tile the two-dimensional plane. So if I look at this picture over here, you know, I have a spiral here, or maybe double spiral somewhere. These things are sending wave fronts out, and there's some zone where wavefronts coming from this center will collide with wavefronts coming from that center, but in the interior of these regions, there's never any confusion. The cells always just see a single set of waves coming from one source, because waves from this source never have a chance to make it to a cell in the interior. So aside from zones at the boundary where cells get confused, this basically introduces what you can think of as some type of breakup of the two-dimensional space, which tells the cells which way to go. So the signaling system, besides making these nice pretty waves that you can study and relate to waves in other systems, is really the way the cells establish a roadmap for themselves about which way they're going to aggregate. So if you follow the pictures further, here are the spirals. Here you begin to see the breakup of the actual cells, where this was a spiral here, which was that spiral there. Now you begin to see black corresponding to no cells at all, and if you follow it further, all the cells are collapsing onto that point over there. Okay? So there's been quite a bit of work on trying to understand things like the density of spirals. You don't always get spirals. At low density, you get target patterns, and there's been quite a lot of literature on that, and I think most things are, I mean, not everything is understood, but most things are generally, so spiral nucleation, is basically random. There's no preset way to know where the centers of those spirals will be. They're not special cells in any way. As opposed to target patterns, which is the alternative pattern you can see, where you can get clumps of cells that just happen to, become oscillatory and act as central signalers, and then they send out a radio wave, and those cells are, either they were hungrier before you started starving them, or they were closer to having just divided, or whatever. There is something special about those cells. But here, there's nothing special about these cells.
Yeah, what's the scale?
What's that, the scale of the spiral?
The
density of the spiral centers.
Yeah.
So, I'm not sure we really know, in a sense. In order to get started from nothingness, this is sort of the fully developed spiral. When you start, the cells are doing nothing, and then you sort of have random firing events because, there's some variance in the distribution of individual cells, and some of them happen to, emit small pulses. So there's a sort of initial stochastic phase where the pattern is sort of seeded in various places that tends to affect the density here. Well, but so it's less sensitive than that because spiral domains can recombine or whatever. So that's not fully understood, is all I can say. What is understood is, why you get spirals, what an individual spiral looks like, why you would get target patterns in, let's say, in low density or in some mutant cells with changed characteristics. But exactly what determines the density of spirals depends on this sort of initial, more random phase, and nobody fully understands that. But in other words, it's not a very, robustness means different things to different people. The mounds can function in the sense of going through the rest of the stage of their development, eventually leading to fluting bodies, with an order of magnitude variation in how many cells are in a mound. They can go from 10,000 to about 100,000. So the size of these individual territories can't be, it's pretty tight. Yeah. I mean, what you see is you see typically a few wavelengths. Now, why do you see a few wavelengths? The reason you see a few wavelengths is because you tend to have enough random scattering events to sort of nucleate things all over the place, and then when the system evolves and creates the pattern, you sort of get this. So what sets the wavelength is there's a theory of excitable media where you look at the reaction diffusion equations that this system obeys, and spiral wavelengths are uniquely determined by solving those equations.
And then
I'm eventually going to get myself back down to the single cell and tell you what a single cell is doing, but it's not really an instability in excitable systems. In other words, it's not that excitable systems are stable It's just that if you create a spiral, it tends to last forever, because it's basically a topological defect in the wave pattern, so it can't do anything. And this, in fact, what you have is, so if the density is high enough, you create enough of these defects to start, and then there's some competition, and you wind up with something that looks like that, roughly. Yes?
And if the density is too high to start off,
does it fail? Well, you see, if the density is too high, the mounds will just break up. So, in other words, if this thing winds up being just a huge spiral for some reason, for example, there are mutants... Oh, well, if it's lots of small spirals, if the spirals are too small, then you have a problem, because then you form a bunch of little tiny individual units, and a lot of them fail at the next stage. And one of the mutant phenotypes you can create is you can basically interfere with this process in a number of ways, you might imagine. And one typical type of phenotype you can see is cases where you wind up with little tiny, mounds and little tiny fruiting bodies and lots of failures because this system doesn't work efficiently enough. No, too many cells down in the dish doesn't hurt you. No, because the system can't support that many centers. Though there's a competitive phase where very close by spirals eat each other, and the system coarsens to something that looks like this. And too many cells doesn't hurt you. Too few cells can hurt you. At least, yes.
Are there any effects?
No, I don't think so. I mean, biology, biologists are funny in the sense that, this protocol of putting things on agar plates and doing this thing has been around for a long time, and it works very well. And if you try to change it in some way, they say, but that's not the natural condition of the system. but none of the, okay, so you got the point. What? The cell can control its wavelength. Sure, if it can adjust. Sure. I mean, if by that you mean that the wavelength depends on the activity level of certain proteins, then the answer is yes. So if the cell can monitor things and change various parameters in the reaction diffusion equation governing this, then the wavelength will certainly be changed. Yes, well, they change certain things. For example, one thing they change is, this is what you see at reasonably high densities. I already said that at low densities, you tend to see target patterns. At low densities, there's a premium on having your waves propagate very far. At high densities, you want your waves to basically be as sharp as possible, so you want to have a large decay constant, so that if you have a sort of burst, you sort of localize the burst. So the cell does, for example, control the chemical that's used to degrade cyclic AMP by its cell density. So there's some feedback loop where the cell has an inhibitor of, so phosphodiesterase is the chemical that degrades cyclic AMP, and there's another protein, phosphodiesterase inhibitor, which is secreted at low density to try to make the range of the waves further to allow the aggregation territories to encompass more cells than they would otherwise. So there are feedback loops, as usual, which try to optimize survivability, but it doesn't have to be as precise as many other systems. I mean, I said at the end of the day, mounds running from 10,000 to 100,000 seem to more or less be okay. Yeah.
Control the size of this by manipulating the parameters of this production.
Yeah, there's a whole, I mean, it's hard to summarize whole literature there's Dictyostelium is a very good system because there is a complete set of protocols for genetic manipulation. You can go in and change any genes you want, add genes, subtract genes, change promoters on genes, do all the standard things that have been, so there's a literature of many, many mutants. The entire genome will be done when, Terry? This next year? What? Yeah, so the entire genome will be known, but there's already a large database of known genes, known mutant phenotypes, and the ones that affect the waves and the signaling system, there's a pretty good story as to understanding how it all fits together, I would say. I mean, at least my, okay. Now, what you noticed in the previous picture is, you know, this picture of these waves propagating, and even though the imaging is done by the cell shape changing, in fact, the cell density overall is not really changing very much during those sort of coherent waves. The cell density starts changing at some point later. Whoops, wrong way. No, can't get back there. So around here, to get from sort of here to this part of the story is where the cells actually start moving in response to the signal. So up to here, they're signaling each other. They're detecting the signal, cyclic AMP. They're creating more cyclic AMP. They're relaying the signal, but they're not going anywhere. Somewhere around this stage, they start moving in response to the wave field that they themselves have created, and that leads very quickly to collapse onto these mounds. So they create the roadmap, and then they follow the roadmap via chemotaxis. Chemotaxis here means just literally following gradients of chemicals in a purposefully motion in a purposeful way. Now, one thing you see here, if you look sort of more carefully, you notice this collapse here is not rotationally symmetric. The collapse actually has a sort of pattern inside it. It looks like a river pattern in, a river pattern if there would be a big hole in the ground somewhere and all the rivers were drained to there. So it looks like a series of sort of one-dimensional lines coming in, and the center place, of course, is not going down, but actually going up. So all the cells are accumulating at the center. And that's called, so here is a picture of what those cells coming in looks like. So you form these sort of streams, and then the cells move into the streams, and then eventually form this puddle at the which was the first stage of that multicellular picture that I showed. And not everybody makes it. You know, efficiency is not 100%. You know, here are people that won't get to live another day. I missed the bus or something. Okay. Whoops. One reason, success is always hard to measure, but one thing that I think has been pretty well established by numbers of groups is that this breakup into streams, the fact that the collapse is not rotationally symmetric but first sort of collapses in the transverse direction to these one-dimensional lines and then come in as sort of one-dimensional things, this is due to some linear instability. And what was worked out was that the basic condition you need is that the wave velocity has to be an increasing function of the cell density, and then once the cells start to move chemotactically, they sort of, regions of high density tend to bias other cells nearby to move towards them and vice versa. And this was then checked independently, just that it indeed is true that the speeds of the waves are an increasing function of the density. And this is a pretty reasonable story that most people, I think, in the field accept. Now, the other thing to notice is that when we talk about chemotaxis in this system, the one thing to remember is the cells are deciding on their motion, but what actually they're using is a traveling wave. What they're actually seeing is not a static gradient pointing them towards the center. They're seeing these waves that pass over them. Even in the streams, there are waves that go down the one-dimensional streams. So the cells have to, unlike static gradients, where the cell essentially has a long integration time. It can sit there, it can measure the concentration on its front end, the concentration on its back end, integrate for some amount of time, and eventually figure out which one is higher. Here the cell has a finite temporal window in which to do that. It's got to make that decision within a relatively short amount of time. We'll see exactly how short that is in a few minutes. as the wave passes over it. Now, you of course can do experiments in dictyostelium cells in static gradients. You know, you can create standard types of chambers that have static gradients, and you can ask whether the cells can figure out which way to move in static gradients. And basically, if they can do this, this is easy. So, in static gradients, they can easily decide which way to move, and the number that's typically quoted in the field is that if you have a gradient that's big enough such that there's a 2% change in the concentration from one end of the cell to the other, the cell is 10 microns across, then the cell can figure out which way to go. Okay, so that's a typical number, but this number is not necessarily the number for a traveling wave, because this is, as I said, this is an easier problem for the cells. Within some reasonable range. I wouldn't say I don't think it's known as well as the corresponding story in E. coli. I think this is just okay. Just one last movie, because this is a nice movie. This is the final stage. Okay, whatever. Okay, back to what the cells are doing. Okay, so here's what an individual cell does in terms of chemotaxis. So now we're going to look down not at the overall behavior, but now we're going to see what happens if you try to understand at a more cellular level what is the basis for the cell response that is needed to build up that multicellular structures. That's worth seeing more. I like that one. Isn't there a way to create that? There's some way to make it loop, but whatever. Here's this poor cell. Or you just decided to torture the cell, and you get the general idea. The cell is pretty responsive. So the light source there is a pipette. Let's see it one more time, now that you've all seen it, now we can discuss it. So over here is a pipette that you barely see being out of focus. It's releasing cyclic AMP. The cell moves towards it. Then you change where you put the pipette. And the cell has to go a different way. So you're just constantly, you have a pipette that's leaking out the chemical cyclic AMP that the cell is using to determine which way to go, and you're making the cell follow it, and that's typically what a single cell is able to do. So single cells move in this standard amoeba-like motion where they sort of send feet out in some direction and pull their butts in behind them, and the idea of how they move directionally is that they choose the direction to send out that foot. So if you look at the movie, you see that when you move the pipette, the cell sort of stops, and then the next foot that's sent out, what's called a pseudopod, is more or less in the direction towards the pipette direction. Okay. Do the cells destroy it? Yes. Yeah, so in that particular assay, I don't quite know what they did. It's just some movie that I dragged out because, trying to give you... but presumably they've put significant amount of this phosphodiesterase enzyme in the material so that when you release it from the pipette, it decays pretty rapidly. So the idea is that, otherwise, it would get very confused. So you've done something to the system that makes, essentially, the gradient is created by locally where the pipette is and everything else is decaying pretty quickly by the experimentalist intervention, not by anything directly done by the cell in that case.
Is that real time?
That's a good question. I think it's pretty much real time, yeah. Yeah. It's not real time, it's very close to real time. But yeah, that's about the right side of time. The problem with getting movies off the web is you don't always know the answer to these things. I didn't want to do that, I wanted to go to the next one. Let me talk about it first then. Now, so when you start talking about the cell biology of how the cell is able to do that, then you get all these diagrams that eventually look the same. There's some network. I mean, what else could there be? There's some network of molecules that is responsible for taking the external signal, the cyclic AMP, and doing two things with it. One thing that you have to do is you have to relay the signal. The setting up of the wave field requires that when you detect cyclic AMP, you relay it, which means you manufacture more cyclic AMP and secrete it so that the wave keeps going through the system. And the other thing you have to do is you have to decide which way to move. So the cyclic AMP signaling part of this is, again, the part most people have studied, both biologists and physicists slash mathematicians, and there's several models that exist, each with their own weaknesses. I don't think there's a very perfect model out there. For anybody who cares about the details of what these models are, you know, I'll be happy to tell you. There are certain things that are clearly known from the point of view of the biology. There's a receptor on the surface, cyclic AMP receptor, which detects the cyclic AMP signal from the outside. This receptor is a G protein coupled receptor, for probably most of you already know what that is, hopefully. That's been suppressed in this picture. So anyway, this thing communicates through a bunch of things in the interior via a sort of a G protein mechanism. It eventually activates this thing called adenyl cyclase. Adenyl cyclase is an enzyme which manufactures cyclic AMP. And then there's a bunch of other stuff in the interior, which is responsible for essentially regulating the response of this system. Essentially, when you bind a lot of cyclic AMP to the system, you know, adapts and turns off the response of this thing, and then you have to wait a while till the cyclic AMP is cleared before you can elicit another response. And there's some internal machinery inside here, which... this is a model which goes through ERK2, is otherwise known as MAP kinase, and then there's some internal cyclic AMP and some internal phosphodiesterase, and there's some network, which I said pieces of which are known, the kinetics of which are very poorly known. Now, one thing which is interesting from the point of view of this process is, you know, you draw this network and you say, okay, this governs the response of the cell, but the response of the cell is actually not a fixed, is not fixed in time. The cells have a coupling between this, you might call it metabolic time scale process, and a much longer gene expression time scale process. So gene expression time scales usually might be hours or so. This wave periodicity in those spirals is typically in the order of a couple of minutes. Anyway, what happens in the system is that initially, when the cells start starving, they actually don't make many of these proteins. So they don't make the cell surface receptor, they don't make adenyl cyclase, they make MAP kinase, they make PKA, but various of these things are not made or not made in the right quantity. When they start starving, they manufacture these genes are induced to turn on by various starvation factors, but they turn on at very low levels. And then the system waits to receive cyclic AMP pulses. The response to an individual pulse is both to relay the signal and to decide which way to move once they start moving, and also to update the gene expression levels. So the gene expression levels are dependent on receiving pulses of cyclic AMP in the system. No. So the whole idea of this reaction diffusion model is that the cyclic AMP emitted by one cell over here will diffuse downstream to the next cell, and that's how the wave will propagate through the system. So, you know, there's a self-consistent wave height that will pass through the system unperturbed. Okay, so this is a nonlinear process with various positive feedback terms and various negative terms, and by the time you're all done, after some transient, you'll create some particular pulse shape which will propagate as like a solitary wave through the system. And that's similar in all the systems. Yeah, Mars. So here, nothing. This is only the signaling circuit. This is not yet the motility. And unfortunately, I'm going to tell you very quickly that we don't know really what controls the motility. Even though we have a good guess as to what controls various aspects of the signaling, we don't quite know as well what controls the motility. I'll show you what we do know in a minute. Now, one thing which is interesting, so first of all, when you see this circuit and you calculate what's going on, just, you know, the cells actually, because this is coupled to gene expression, actually go from being more or less non-responsive to being excitable, which technically means they can propagate waves, but they can't initiate waves on their own, eventually to being self-oscillatory, which means not only can they propagate waves, but left to their own, they will also initiate their own self-oscillation. So this actually happens as the cell, you know, ages, in quote, as it gets more and more time passes after the starvation period. And so, if, for example, you just put all these cells in a test tube and wait, something around 6 hours after starvation, you'll actually begin to see just spontaneous oscillations in the test tube as the cells become self-oscillatory and you can just see them oscillate, again, by this light scattering method. No, a whole population. Well, put a single cell. I'm not quite sure.
I don't understand the initiation.
Well, self-oscillatory basically means a single cell.
Yeah.
Right?
It needs input from others to get it going.
No, so,
right,
so in other words, well, what the current theory is, due to me, the current theory of this is that there's an initial variance in cell population. Some of the cells become oscillatory before the others, and they serve as the initiation sites for the whole colony. So you get... Oh, it's just in... For example, how soon before, you know, how much time has elapsed since the last time they divided before starvation. So if the cell just divided right before you went through the starvation protocol, it wants to eat really badly. So the induction of the genes that, you know, due to starvation is just faster. And, you know, cells are individuals, so there can be just changes in the rate at which various genes accumulate for any number of stochastic reasons.
But you can put the cell by itself and the start starvation at different point in the cell cycle and see.
In principle, that's been very hard to do. It's just been very hard to do. And then you have to say, how are you going to tell that a single cell is oscillating? It's not that easy either, because you can't detect cyclic AMP levels, so you can... It's just, you know.
Is that a way to synchronize the cell cycle?
No one has succeeded very well. It's not as good as yeast, where you can really synchronize. You can try to do some things, but it's been. Okay, so now, in each cycle, there's a host of measurable changes that go on inside the cell. Here's just some particular, just what typical experiment looks like. So, so these are now typical biochemistry experiments where you don't look at individual cells, you just take a whole bunch of cells and you, here is where you hit them with cyclic AMP, and what happens is, here is again hitting it with cyclic AMP, there's a rise in the internal cyclic AMP level. And the thing to notice here is that it takes about a couple of minutes for the internal cyclic AMP level to rise. So it takes maybe 1.5 minutes or so. Whereas some other internal second messenger, in other words, something else that happens, takes about maybe 10 seconds or so, maybe 15 seconds. This is a cyclic GMP response to, again, exciting the cell. There are others. There's this activation of this kinase, and that's sort of an intermediate scale, 30 seconds. So when you apply a signal to the cell, you basically, you know, get a whole bunch of responses that go on in some complicated way over the next couple of minutes. And what's not shown here is you also, once the cells are going to start to move, you also get an increase in actin polymerization in response to a cyclic AMP cell, which again, if you just measure by biochemical techniques. So this doesn't tell you what a single cell is doing, this just gives you some biochemistry. You can't even see that. This didn't work, as I suspect. So, forget it. Is that better? Well, let me just move on quickly. Now, let me show you another experiment. So, one of the most important questions, in a sense, is how fast can the cell decide which way to move? They have to decide by the time the wave, you know, by the time the wave has passed over them. So there's an upper bound that if they're going to be able to move in a wave that's going over them, if they wait till the complete pulse has passed them by, obviously it's too late. So there's an upper bound of, let's say, a minute or two, where we knew that already. But there's been a recent set of experiments over the last year or two that actually suggests that the response of the cells in deciding which way to go is much, much more quick. So this is an experiment. It's going to be very hard to see. I'm going to show you this one first. So this is a dictyostelium cell. And this one's going to be put in a uniform bath of cyclic AMP. And okay. No, this is a single cell. Let me do that again. Let's see. Should have had these loop. So I usually do. So at some point, you see this bright band around the outside of the cell. Now this is a cell. As I said, dictyostelium is great because you can do all these genetic manipulations. This is an experiment due to Peter Devriotis. What he's done is he's taken one of the elements, one of the protein elements of that signaling system that I showed in its schematic form. This one is called CRAC, C-R-A-C. That stands for cytosolic resident activator of cyclase. But doesn't matter. He's taken CRAC, he's fused green fluorescence protein to it, and asked what happens as you apply cyclic AMP to the system, not looking now at the biochemical response of, you know, applying it in a test tube and then grinding up, you know, a liter of cells and measuring cyclic AMP levels, now looking at it actually at the level of individual cells. And what he showed in his paper is that the CRAC protein, when you apply cyclic AMP to the cell, and I don't understand all the this bright line is a localization of that protein to the cell membrane. Now, it's known in this system that, again, but mostly by genetic means, if you knock out this CRAC, if you get rid of it, the cells can't signal. So this is an essential element of the signal transduction pathway. It's known that in order to work, it has to hop onto the cell membrane. It somehow receives a signal, maybe directly, maybe not, from these G proteins, and then it is modified, and the cell membrane maybe is modified, and it jumps onto the membrane, and once it's on the membrane, it then activates adenyl cyclase. So it's an essential piece of the plumbing that actually activates adenyl cyclase, and what you see directly is it jumping onto the membrane. Now, what you see over here, here is now a pipette experiment. Yes. Yes. So yeah, so the world is broken down into two pieces about this question that you just asked. This result of seeing this very bright line and associating it with a physiological as opposed to an optical effect is believed by most people. There's some stubborn various other people who aren't so sure. And we actually tried reproducing some of this at San Diego, and we could not reproducibly get the same things that they got.
No. You
don't see lines in the middle. So it could be some optical imaging effect going through, you know. Unfortunately, this has been reproduced in other cell types. It turns out that not only dictyostelium cells do chemotaxis, but neutrophils, which do chemotaxis, also exhibit a motion of that over to the membrane. If you can do this more carefully in this experiment. So it, most people believe that you're not just seeing an imaging artifact. That's all I can say. Yes. Is this a yes? Some, you know, they do. Yeah, but I'm just saying that we, you know, there are imaging artifacts that, you know, I'm just saying that we spent a frustrating 6 months last year, probably with not a good enough microscope. And I wasn't me sitting in front of the microscope, it was mostly Chinwin. But you can see this sometime, and in fact, I was reading, you know, I was trying to prepare for this talk on zero notice, and I was looking at the paper on neutrophils, which does this. Neutrophils also have chemotaxis, not the cyclic AMP, but to some other small peptide fragment, and they show these pictures, and then you read the fine print in the footnote, you know, in the references in Science, where it says, we observed similar patterns in 15 out of 23 cells. Or something like that, and then in the other cells we saw complicated patterns, we weren't sure what they meant, or something. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make sure of what exactly is being seen. Okay. With all those caveats, if you take their word for it, let me just show you the other movie from them. So here you have a pipette over here. We'll start again. No, won't start again. I don't have this thing in loop mode. It's not good. And you're supposed to be interpreting these bright bands that come and go as the response of this GFP protein to the release of cyclic AMP over there. If you take their word for it, if you believe their experiments, they show that the time scale it takes to do that is on the order of 10 seconds. So each of those frames, you know, the final frame here is basically 10 seconds after the first frame. And similarly over here, you're seeing frames that are sort of, you know, 5 seconds each. What that means is that the cell, if you put a pipette here, is able to make a decision that it's going to move this way within 5 seconds of seeing the concentration go up on its leading edge. Okay, that's what that's... So that's a very strong result, if true. Okay. Now, so this is just repeating what I told you. Crack, which is a needed piece of the cyclic AMP signaling system, is recruited to the membrane on the side nearest to the source. This happens very quickly, and this is not the, it's not only this one. It turns out there's some specific protein domain on this protein that causes it to be recruited to the membrane, and other proteins with this domain in dictyostelium and in neutrophils also behave the same way. For those of you who got tired of seeing proteins, this is what the domain looks like. So, questions to ponder based on what I admittedly has been a very, you know, random view of what's going on here at the single cell level. So these are questions to ponder. There's a traveling pulse going over the cell. So the cell is seeing a gradient that's, you know, during half the cycle points this way, during the other half the cycle points that way. It's obviously only responding to the gradient pointing one way. So it's got to do that by somehow making itself insensitive to the gradient during the other part of the cycle. Now that's not so bad in a sense, because we know already that the cyclic AMP receptor is somehow becoming desensitized. You can't, you know, it goes into some insensitive state, and so therefore when the back half is passing, you know, whatever thing has caused the receptor to go into this desensitized state is presumably interfering with the ability to measure the gradient in the reverse direction, so the cell doesn't reverse. The cell is sitting in its quiescent state, the pulse hits it, it sees a gradient across it lasting for some time as the wave passes, as the leading edge of the pulse passes over it, decides which way to go, and by the time the back edge passes over it, it's already in a non-responsive state. So that's probably not so bad. This one is much harder. If we go back to the pipette experiment of Devriotis, you see you put the pipette down, and cyclic AMP oozes out of the pipette. and it hits the front end of the cell, and the cell, the front end of the cell responds 5 seconds later or 10 seconds later. Now, the cyclic AMP continues to diffuse around the cell, comes around the back of the cell, hits the back of the cell, and the back of the cell will respond 5 or 10 seconds later, at least it should, so, but it doesn't. So something has gotten there first. There's something that has reached the back of the cell before the cyclic AMP has gotten there, saying, I've already been hit in the front, please don't respond in the back. If each piece of membrane is acting independently, then there's no way this can work. So something has to go from the part of the cell that was hit to the parts of the cell, the front, the leading edge that's facing the pipette, to the edge that's the back of the cell, away from the pipette. Something has to get across the cell before the cyclic AMP gets around the cell. Otherwise, the back of the cell is fine. It just gets excited. It's a local event, and there's no problem. So you ask, what can do that? Yes? Yes. So one possibility is you've depleted all the crack, right? One possibility is you've depleted all the crack. So that doesn't quite work. The problem is crack can't diffuse fast enough to be depleted completely out of the cell membrane in that time scale. Crack is a reasonably large protein. You only deplete it near the, you know, you can figure out how much crack could you deplete, making some guess as to what the binding constant would be, and you just can't diffuse crack fast enough from the back edge of the cell to get rid of it. So that doesn't work. That's a possibility you have to check. Yes? The which? Cyclic AMP? Yeah, so you might say, well, the back of the cell is receiving a much lower concentration. I don't know the, yeah. So it's possible, right, so, yeah, so your question is, maybe I'm sub-threshold in the back of the cell. Right, that's a possibility. Okay, don't. But that would depend on the absolute concentration and things like that. So, I don't think that's the answer, but I can't. I better, you know, that has to be looked into. But you know, you could easily test that by just said releasing 10 times as much cyclic AMP and seeing if you got any change in the pictures. No, there's a gradient. No, but the problem is not that there's a gradient. The problem is you have the front end of the cell that sees the cyclic AMP rise and does its thing locally. You know, it binds to CAR1, releases G proteins, they create some local disturbance. None of those proteins can make it across the cell in the time it takes cyclic AMP to go around the cell. So there's a local disturbance. Now you increase cyclic AMP on the back of the cell. Why don't you create the same local disturbance there? What's changed in that 10 seconds? Yeah, so one possibility, right. So about what you were suggesting, which I think is in principle possible, is that somehow your concentration on the back edge of the cell is sub-threshold. So you don't have enough to make a local excitation. That's easily checked, but I better just check. Okay. But either that's true, or there's been some communication from the front to the back. Right, that's the point. So, okay, so I can give you a list of what the possibilities are. The possibility which is the least, so there's never been detected any voltage-gated channels in dicastelium. You know, there's no one knows of anything that could be propagated via membrane potentials. Attempts to do what's it called, patch clamp, have not worked in dicastelium. No one has been able to measure voltage changes. Certainly a voltage change could get across the cell faster than any chemical change. Okay, so the way we're looking at this is we're trying to rule out, you know, the simplest things and then try, maybe we'll find something exciting. So the simplest thing is that there is a chemical like cyclic GMP, which is created very quickly upon stimulation, which manages to diffuse across the interior of the cell fast enough to suppress the response in the back. That's the simplest interpretation. Cyclic GMP is almost the only candidate for that. There's nothing else that rises very quickly. There's, except for cyclic GMP, there was a thought that maybe calcium concentrations could do that. Calcium, after all, can diffuse pretty quickly. People tested that in a very nice experiment published just very recently, the last few months, where they showed that chemotaxis was not damaged in any way by knocking out the essentially the calcium, the IP3 receptor, for those of you who know what how calcium works inside cells. They knocked out the IP3 receptor, totally diminished the calcium response inside the cell to chemotactic stimuli, and yet saw no change in the chemotactic response. So most people, you know, at least you look at the paper, doesn't look like there are too many loopholes. Calcium is not playing a direct role in regulating chemotaxis in the system. So you're left with basically one molecule, which is cyclic GMP.
But the diffusion in the cell is slower than outside.
It's slower. Yeah, we don't, maybe it's, you know, it is. It's slower, you know, it's a straighter line. So from my point of view, the most exciting result would be if you can't make it work with cyclic GMP, because then you're faced, as far as we've been able to think of, exactly two possibilities. One is the one that was just mentioned, that there's some voltage, some electrical potential that's communicating from the front to the back. The other possibility, which I don't know if it's real either, is that there's some type of mechanical wave that can propagate through the cell at a faster speed, somehow involving the actin cortex or something like that. But there's got to be something. I mean, so that's why it's interesting, because if you keep pushing on this, eventually you've got to figure out what that something is, or else the experiments are wrong, which of course is another possibility here.
What about the possibility that the wave passes the cell, is creating turbulence, so it's mixing the turbulence?
Yeah, these are too tiny. These are, I mean, you know, the cell is 10 microns, so it's pretty hard to do that. I mean, in other words, just essentially at this scale, most, you know, all chemicals diffuse. I mean, you can create small motions, but the cell would have to undergo large, I mean, you know, the cells don't undergo large changes on that time scale. I mean, they do undergo large shape changes, but on a smaller time scale, on a longer time scale. Okay, now, so this is really hard. This is, I think, the most interesting part of the problem, which, you know, I don't know if we have enough data right now to figure it out, but that's what we've been thinking about. There's also there's a cycle. I shouldn't have wanted to, whoops. I don't know if you can see this at all. Forget about all the rest of this. This is just the easiest place to get. If you watch a cell actually moving in a gradient, what you see is, you actually see that the cell motion, I mean, it really does look like some cycle of motion. It looks like, you know, it sends out a pseudopod, it pulls its rear up. It sends out a pseudopod, it pulls its rear up, sends out another pseudopod. Directed motion just means that there's a strong bias for the direction in which it sends out those pseudopods. So there's an underlying cycle involved somehow in the cell organizing itself to send out or, you know, the leading edge, and then to consolidate, and then to send out another leading edge. And in principle, you'd like to understand that cycle also, not only understand the basic idea of how the cell makes the decision, but how the entire cycle works together. Now, there's different parts of this problem. There's what part we're trying to focus on, because we think there's at least some information available, is the part about the decision making of the cell. In other words, how it decides which way it's going to move and how it suppresses things in other parts of the cell once it's made that decision. There's a whole other question of just the mechanics of how the cell actually moves. I mean, it's got to then take this decision, which of course is some, you can think of it as having a small gradient across the cell which creates an amplified gradient internal to the cell. Okay, that's a decision, an amplified gradient internal to the cell, where the cell internally now knows, oh yeah, that's the front, this is the back, these are the sides, I now have to organize. And then the question is, you know, you've got to build your entire mechanical structure to actually make the move. And that's a whole separate problem, which is certainly worth thinking about. The problem is, it's probably premature to do that in dictyostelium. There are probably simpler systems where actin-based motility is still is worth studying, but This chemotactic decision in a eukaryotic cell, I think dictyostelium is probably the simplest system to focus on this question. Okay, let me just give you 1 second about what we're actually trying to do. So we have some simple model which we've been playing with to try to understand these questions. It doesn't really matter, but the basic assumption is going to be, I mean, we have some states of the cell membrane, but the basic assumption in the model, the thing which makes it work, if at all, is the statement that internal cyclic GMP will prevent activation of the signaling and motion system by external cyclic AMP signals. And there's no, you know, we have no choice but to just sort of put it all together, take the best numbers we can, and try to see if we can make it work. And we may not be able to, because it's really tough to get that time scales to work out and to get everything to work out. We may just not, I mean, it's, you know, it's a little bit hard to prove a no-go theorem in this. I mean, you can work for 6 months, and if you don't make a model for something, it may be that you're just too stupid. On the other hand, it may be that there really is some more interesting, you know, well, more, you know, non-chemical means of communication that really would have to be taken into account. So our goal is to make a pretty standard-looking model, assuming cyclic GMP is the thing which is able to do this inhibition and get across the cell fast enough. And we have a bunch of experiments involved, you know, in this motion cycle, the fact you can phase lock this motion cycle by external cyclic AMP, no, you know, just temporal variations, reorientation experiments. There are a large number of experiments which can serve both as input and tests of this model, and this is where we are, trying to do that. And anyway, that was my best attempt at giving a review on no notice.
Yeah. Is there any difference in these experiments depending on whether they were performed in the doctor or the
lab? Let's see, the cells do respond to light, but how would the cell use that internally? In other words, there is a cell response to... No. I'm just trying to think through your question while standing on my feet. And the cells do respond to light. If you, you know, shining light on them will change various responses. And those changes are, for example, thought to be responsible for this feature of slugs, which is phototaxis. They actually will turn and orient themselves in light, in gradients of light. But I don't see how they would use that internally to communicate across the cell. On the other hand, voltage changes basically propagate to, you know, the speed of light. I mean, it's, in other words, they're instantaneous on the scale of any chemical communication across the cell. If there really were a perturbation in the local voltage in the cell membrane, then the whole cell would know about that instantaneously on the time scale here. Now, I should mention that one thing this has led us to is to try to design, in collaboration with some people at Cornell, try to design an experiment where you don't just have a sort of single pipette, you know, with some unknown concentration profile, to actually have a well-designed chamber with multiple sources where we can dial in precisely what concentration in space and time the cells will see. And, you know, in other words, to make sure, for example, of your question, you know, is there a we can have exactly the same concentration appear on the front and the back with a time lag of 5 seconds. We can have it with a time lag of 1 second. And eventually at some, you know, if it can suppress it in 1 second, then we know cyclic GMP can't get across. So this idea of having multiple sources in a well-controlled chamber is what we're trying to proceed with that experimentally, as in collaboration with a group at Cornell. Yeah.
There was the highest frequency you can phase lock.
So they didn't. I don't think the experiment I know didn't try it, but you know, presumably it's also the shortest frequency that these waves can sort of exist. So it's in the order of a couple of minutes, like 2 or 3 minutes. In other words, the phase lock experiment, basically the easiest way to think about it is that there's some internal oscillation and now you're driving the system, and as long as those frequencies are not too far apart, you'll just lock to the external phase. So the internal frequency is typically in the range of 5 minutes or so. So if you drive it with anything around 5 minutes, you know, 3 to 7, let's say, then you will phase lock to the external frequency. Where, so the external frequency is just you have the thing in a uniform spatial but temporally varying bath of cyclic AMP. And if you go much lower than that, you'll get things like you get a response every other excitation. You'll get period doubling in response. So, but there's not been any real investigation of that as far as I've been able to tell. Yeah. Right, but this translocation of this protein to the membrane happens long before you begin to see any shape changes, long before you start building up actin polymerization at the front and start actually expanding. You see that, I mean, that all takes about a minute, you know, 30 seconds or a minute. So you see this translocation immediately, and you don't see it at the back. So it's, yeah, I mean, if you had a minute, then you might say, okay, actin starts polymerizing at the front, and all sorts of things build up at the front by the time, you know, you don't have enough to, you know, it's a race or something. But here, it's not a question of a race. Here, it's they've got to be in some type of communication to prevent the response at the back. Yeah. Yes. Well, it's produced by, you know, just like cyclic AMP is produced by adenyl cyclase or adenyl cyclase, depending on which book you read. It's produced by guanyl cyclase. It's produced from GTP, I guess, right? So it's produced from GTP by an enzyme, guanyl cyclase. But it has nothing directly to do with the G protein. It's activated by the same pathway, but it's, I mean... So there's only been two mutants so far. There's been one mutant which did something to guanyl cyclase and does interfere with chemotaxis, but it's a sort of, I mean, it's not very precise in the sense that maybe you just hit it over the head with a hammer and you broke 10,000 pieces in it. So, and then there's a very curious set of mutants which were created before, which are called streamer mutants, which actually do chemotaxis better than normal. They actually move in, you know, longer straight lines. And again, there's some evidence to suggest that you know, in other words, if you look at the cyclic GMP response, the biggest biochemical change associated with that mutant is the increased amount of cyclic GMP, you know, delay in cyclic GMP decay or whatever. But that particular mutant was created in the ancient history of adding mutagen chemicals to the system, and people don't really know what it is that they mutated. They're just a mutant. Whereas the new one, there's some other thing, which some other gene which seems to interfere somehow with guanyl cyclase activity, and it does basically destroy chemotaxis. So there's very limited circumstantial supporting evidence that say the cyclic GMP is not irrelevant. But that's about it.
What else is in the soup that when you sprinkle the cyclic
AMP? What else is in the soup? You mean when you do the experiment in the lab, what's in the agar?
Yeah.
Basically nothing.
You don't need sodium potassium at all?
No.
So that would kind of...
No. Well... I don't think you need, I mean, as far as I know, you don't need any special ionic strengths in the solution to do any of this, but... I don't know precisely what the limits are that would set on... You don't need seawater. No, you don't use seawater. You use the deionized water coming out of the lab tap or whatever to make the agar. At least that's what I did. You know.
Yeah. trying to get the concentration, and you did my turbulence.
Yeah.
What about access of cyclase, not cyclase, of the one that breaks the cycle?
Yes.
Is any of that on the surface?
Some of it is on the surface, apparently. Some of it is on the surface, as far as I know. There is a membrane bound, you know, for some, you know, reasons that I'm sure make some sense eventually. There's both phosphodiesterases that are secreted by the cells, and there are also phosphodiesterases that remain bound to the membrane of the cell. I don't know why you'd want to do both, but nonetheless, the cell does both. I mean, that's really why we want to go to a more controlled system where we can impose and measure the cyclic AMP concentration in our own control chamber, because it's hard to know precisely what the cell is doing to regulate cyclic AMP. But, I mean, if it really were just sub-threshold, it would be, you know, in other words, Boris, when they do these pipette experiments, they're interested in pretty pictures to publish in whatever. And the way you get the nicest pictures is not to work near the threshold. So they typically have a huge amount of cyclic AMP compared to the natural waves that they're releasing in these things, which is why the thing just, you know, stops and just turns. You know, and natural cells, you know, are operating sort of closer to the margin than that. So I just tend to doubt your explanation, but I should check to be sure. But that's a way of saying that usually my understanding of these pipette experiments is they're flooding the system with cyclic AMP. There's just no chance to dilute it or decay it fast enough to make the response at the back go below the threshold. The threshold's very low for cyclic AMP detection. It's 10 nanomolar, and, you know.
What's the highest concentration produced by cells?
And it, so the peak of the waves is supposed to go up to around probably a micromolar or something. So the peaks of the waves are, you know, the numbers you see, the guesses based on the one snapshot experiment and other indicators are micromolar range. So, but the pipettes are really, you know, huge concentrations. Just as I said, you really want to get the nicest picture. And No, so in fact, there's a very nice experiment with a GFP-coupled receptor, which shows that the receptors remain uniformly distributed on the surface. So there's no depletion of receptors. That was tested and shown definitively to be not the case. So it's an internal organization asymmetry. It's not a signal detection asymmetry in that sense. Okay.